I just test it, just to check that the whole thing's working, first of all. Right, that should be enough. Is it? Interview with Bill Dunn, 11/11/82. Well, just to go straight into it, you didn't start off in the health service, Bill?
No, I worked as I was a Royal Marine for a number of years, and a regular Royal Marine, and then went into working on the oil business, where I become an activist. And
was it in the North Sea?
No, before the North Sea ever was thought of. I was down to go on one rig called the Sea Gem, and that, as you know, collapsed. But before then, they'd offered me a job in pipeline, so I never got to actually go on the rig, you know, and it collapsed with a few of my friends on it. But, you know, like I say, just the luck of the draw. Maybe somebody up there does love me after all. And then I met my wife, and at 38 years of age, and decided the time for trotting around the world was all over, and that I should settle down, and if you're going to have kids, I believe you should be with them, and try and give them the right values in life, and let them see that family life is a matter of two people living together in some sort of harmony, and having the right principles, and to teach your children that. So I looked around for a job to keep me at home, and to give me a certain amount of standing in the community, I suppose. You know, I could have took any big paying job, or I was fairly qualified as a plant hire and one or two other things, but I felt I wanted to do something that was worthwhile, you know. So I become an ambulance man, and that is where I am to this day, you know, and wouldn't want to change it, really.
That's great. Did you have any, was there any trade unionism or politics in your family at all? Or?
Well, no, I was an orphan, really. I was brought up in Dr. Bernardo's, and my first introduction into politics was by a lady by the name of Bessie Braddock. I don't know if you'd remember her. And her husband, Jack, and they used to be governors of the school, the Dr. Bernardo.
You come from Liverpool?
That's right, yeah. And they used to come and visit quite frequently, and they kind of take a fancy to me and my brothers and sisters, and used to take us out fairly regular. And quite often, those days out would be to miners' galas or dock workers' reunions or something like that, you know, and we pretty soon realised that, you know, the value of the trade union movement and the value of the labour movement, and it became my life, you know. It was something, I respected both of them, I knew their principles were beyond reproach, and I just admired them and respected them, and I thought, well, that's not a bad way to live your life, trying to do something else for somebody else, you know, or the strong looking after the weak, you know. And that's how I saw it, and as a kid, you know. And I suppose I've been committed ever since.
That's interesting.
Yeah, but no, I don't remember my father or my mother. And my brothers, three of them were regular soldiers or sailors, and they were killed during the war. And so they had no politics, you know. But during my service with the Royal Marines, I was on one day on a kit inspection. They also had a locker inspection, and they found a Labour Party card in there, you know, where I was a fully paid up member. And I was quickly run up in front of the commanding officer and told, get your arse out of this, you know, that we don't want any of you subversive commies in here. And well, I didn't drop out of the Labour Party. I had to give him an assurance that I would. And
how long were you in the army?
In the Royal
Marines.
In the Royal
Marines. Oh, you kicked me out of the house.
18 years altogether from boys' service, you know.
Yeah.
But
that's quite a common thing, isn't it? Go from the orphanage into the armed forces.
Well, you're well institutionalised, you know.
And
you can stand it better than most, and you're maybe the best type of person to be in that kind of situation, you know. Because you're not always looking round over your shoulder for your mammy, you're your own man, you know.
So you didn't really choose it as much as it was kind of... Is that, or am
I
wrong?
I did choose it. No, I did choose it. I chose to be in the Irish Guards because my eldest brother was an Irish Guardsman. And just as I was walking to join that morning, I had to cross the Haymarket in Liverpool to get to St John Street, where all the recruiting officers are. And I see this guy striding across the Haymarket in lovely navy blue suit, you know, and big red sash across his chest. And I said to him, "Excuse me, where's the recruiting office for the Irish Guards?" "Up there, laddie," he said, you know. And I said, "What are you?" "Me," he said, "I'm a Royal Marine." The way he said it, that changed me. You know, I wanted to be a Royal Marine. And again, that was something else in my life I never regretted. Mm. You know, though, at the same time, that was what made me a pacifist.
Mm.
That's what made me an ardent supporter of nuclear disarmament. That's what made me a total supporter of peace at any price, you know, and I believe that. I believe that now, I believe the fighting for war is like screwing for virginity, you know. You can't do it.
Did you see any active service at all?
Well, quite a lot, yeah. Mm. I was in Burma, I was in Korea, Borneo, Suez, Cyprus, Kenya.
Quite a thing.
But a few. I was also mentioned in dispatches twice for acts outside of the normal run-of-the-mill things, you know. Someone's got to get it, I suppose, and they dish it out of a hat, but I was quite proud to get them at the time, you know. But napalm really made me a confirmed pacifist.
What, that was in what, Malaya?
That was in Korea.
Korea, rather, also, yeah. I didn't realise they used it as early as that.
That's right, yeah. The back end of Korea, it was first used, and when you're seeing villages, you know, where they bounce to try and wipe out the position of the other side, you know, and the bombs would just carry on bouncing straight over onto a village or to where there was a load of civilians who had no part to play at all other than keep out of the way, you know. And there was kids burnt and women and all of that business. Well, then, you know, if that doesn't make you a pacifist, if that doesn't make you totally opposed to war, then nothing will, in my book, you know. And shortly after Korea, I come out, you know, 53, I was come out, I just had the option and I come out. And ever since then, I've been a pacifist.
Mm. Is that one reason why you went into the health service in particular, or?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that really, at that stage, or at the stage when I was making up my mind to become an ambulance man, I think I just basically wanted a job that had some contact with other people, and if, you know, on the way along, you could have done them a bit of good, well then, that was the kind of job I wanted. You know, I could have just as easy considered being a bus driver or a bus conductor to be with other people, but I felt the ambulance man, you know, there was going to be some reward in the job. There wasn't much financial reward, you know. I think I joined and it was about £12.15 a week, and I used to spend that on a night out, you know, and twice as much as that, but we struggled by and we got by. I don't think we've ever regretted it, you know.
What part of the country was this?
This was in London.
It was in London.
I joined, we lived in Golders Green at that time. And I joined from there, you know. Mm. And that was about 16 years ago. So, you know, I'm getting to be an old hand at it now. Mm. Or I'm getting quite used to it.
When did you join the which union did you, I mean, how did you get involved in trade unionism and ambulance service? Did you carry it from you, from the old rig?
I knew I had to belong to a trade union. Not that there was a closed shop at that stage or anything like that, but I knew that basically because I was me, I would want to belong to the current trade union or one of the current trade unions, as there's four in the health service. So I decided, while I was doing my training, to wait until I got to my main station and see what union the majority of them were in, and then make up my mind what union to join, you know. And as luck would have it, I got to Park Royal Station, where it was 95% cosy. So I joined Cozy right away, you know. And I decided that I wouldn't be an activist, you know. I couldn't see the need for me to be an activist at that station. They were fairly well breached with shop stewards, and there was a couple of very ardent people there, like Bob Simkin and Jim O'Brien, who was an executive member of this union at the end. And so there was no real need for me to become a total activist. While I did get involved, you know, I never actually become a shop steward or anything like that. And I enjoyed the work I was doing, and, you know, things didn't seem too bad. And then I moved to Greenford Station, and I was quite appalled at Greenford Station, because there were some of them there were in the Federation of Ambulance Personnel. There was one of them in UP, another couple in Transport and General. And out of the 14, I think there was about 7 unions involved, you know, and it was obvious they were ripe for a rip-off. And I was the only Cozy member there, you know. And I spoke to them, I said, this is crackers, you know, what we got to do is all get in one union and be solid, and so as we can kind of, if anything does happen to us, we've got the chance to battle against it, you know, as one body. So nobody wanted to change, obviously, you know, nobody, I certainly wouldn't have left Cozy having joined, so I could understand their point of view. Although FAP was on the failing side then, you know, it's already started to fall to pieces. So eventually the guy I was working with, I suppose he got pissed off with me. Oh, shouldn't have said that.
It's all right, don't worry.
I suppose he got browned off with me forever talking about Cozy and why it was a good thing and how it was a health service union and, you know, we should eventually consider it. He joined, and then another guy joined. So there was 3 of us, you know, and then the management mounted a little attack on the station because they wanted to add another line on the rotor. And I said, well, look, this is what I've been
fighting. What's another line? What does that
mean? It means that, you know, your rotor will change, your hours of working will change. And what they wanted to do was at the end of our 9-week rotor, add another week of days, which would have altered all our leave entitlements and everything else, you know. So I said to the guys and the girls up there, I said that this is what I've been scared of. Now here we are, you know, with all factions, and we're not going to get anywhere. You know, we're going to have no head to fight for us, like, you know. And I said, we're going to be beat. Anyway, they all had a meeting, a station meeting. You couldn't call it a union meeting, you know. And we just thrashed it out. And they all decided they'd all join one union. And then the argument become, what union, you know? I said, well, you know, this is my sticking point. I can't join anything but Cozy. I said, I'm the oldest hand here, you know, I've been in the service the longest. I said, and, you know, I'd be throwing away a lot of benefits. I said, but you were in Newbie and that, you've only been in 2 or 3 years, you know, you're not going to lose the same things. So eventually, at the end of the day, they all joined Cozy.
And so we took. And that was the major reason for the
show? That was the major reason, yeah.
Not
that
particular was, loyalty to one union representing one point of view?
No. There's very little loyalty, I find, in the health service to a union. Mm. I find the health workers are more loyal to the branch secretaries. They look at the branch secretary, and if he's strong and if he's got a bit of charisma about him and if he's the man who's doing the job and if he's keeping the management off the backs of his members, well, that's the union they join, you know. And they openly call it at my hospital Bill Dunn's union, you know. Now, I don't agree with that and I think it's wrong, you know, but if that's how they can identify with a union, and if the branch secretary is sound and he's a good trade unionist himself, well, then maybe it's not a bad thing. It certainly keeps him on his toes because he knows if he starts letting them down, they're going to go somewhere else. And I find this is one of the problems in the health service, that they quickly go to other unions, you know, if they're not getting their own way.
It's a question of why the branch secretaries join particular unions then, isn't it?
That's right. I think it's why a branch secretary keeps banging his head against the wall. You know, there's got to be something more than just a union, because it's easy for him to change. You know, it has been done. Branch secretaries, you know, in this area have left Cosy, gone into New, because there's no end of trouble. But, you know,
because ambulance personnel, not just men, just men.
That's right.
The thing. I mean, can I use the word notorious for swapping, aren't they? Is that wrong?
Well, it used to be more than it is now. At one stage of the game, they would swap for the most ridiculous of reasons, you know, a wrong word from a regional officer or an area officer would take a whole station out of one union and put it in the other, you know, and the guy wouldn't even know what he'd said. Or he didn't even have to say it, they only had to think he was implying it and he'd be out, you know. But while I was a convener for the ambulance service, we formed, or we got the management to agree to a membership qualification that you had to be a member of a union to become a member of the union. And I must admit, that has slowed it down an awful lot. That stopped the chopping and changing. And it makes it more easier to deal. But again, I think in that situation, in the ambulance situation, again, it goes with the branch secretary. You know, if the branch secretary gets round off of the union and he changed, like, you know, I'm convinced, and I don't say this big-headedly, but I think if I walked into my station tomorrow and I said, look what Cosy's done to us, bang, 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 I'm going to join Newpey, that station would follow me, you know, because they know I won't let them down. They know I wouldn't, you know, take them along the bad road. There's no way of me doing that. Like, let me first qualify that, you know, no way could I do that. Because I'm committed to Cosy. I believe in Cosy. I believe I'd like to see it a little bit more left wing. I think it's a bit too on the right. But a lot too much on the right. But basically, their ideas are sound, you know.
But that's more than just benefits now, presumably. I mean, it started. You mean that loyalty has grown, that belief in, like, industrial unionism? Or
oh, yeah, work? I think, you're talking about me?
Yes,
I've always been loyal to Cosy. I've never, from the day one I joined, that was me. I was going to stay in Cosy then, no matter what, till I left the service, because I, for one, don't believe in changing my union. I believe in changing the union I belong to. I believe that is it very important. Otherwise, why the hell belong? You know, I've built up a strong branch because I want to be a powerful figure at conference. I want to have my words listened to. I don't want any national officer being so strong that he can say to me, shut your mouth, sit down, you know, you got 50 members, what are you talking about? They can't say that to me. I got over 800, you know. I'm a big branch. So, you know, within reason, people have a listen to what I say. And I think we've done as much good in the union as anyone else, you know. I think we've argued against, we've turned the executive over with some of our attacks at conference, you know.
For example?
Well, one that I really remember was, I think we had about 60 or 70 odd members at the time, you know, and it meant that I was putting into this union about 2 or 3 quid a week. I'm travelling, you know, and I don't mind that. But Bob Farthing come up with this grand plan that each branch would pay its own affiliation fees. Well, I wanted to affiliate to the Labour Party. I also wanted to affiliate to the Trades Council. But if I'd have had to do it, would have been Bill Dunn paying it, you know, because I had a small branch and had very little returns coming back from the union. So, you know, and I think, to be honest, you work harder with a small branch because you're out every day trying to get new members, you know, trying to get your 150 so you can have 2 delegates to regional conference. And you're always chasing members, you know, because you get fed up of being the little fish. And I got up and I talked against his resolution. And we beat them then, you know, that was decided that wouldn't happen. Over the big rise they decided to have, you know, I thought that rise was too much, even though the union were in trouble. You know, I thought there was lots of internal economies they could have made, and I still think that, you know. Your very thing, the history of the union, I believed at that stage, you know, that was one of the internal economies, you know. It didn't seem to me to be straight that it was us looking at being short of money and then commissioning a guy to write the history of the union. No,
it wasn't put over very well, it, by the platform, the union, the history, was it?
I don't think I'll ever need to put it over. If you're in financial difficulties, you don't go out and buy yourself a new three-piece suite. You know, you do with what you've got. And so I, at that stage, and you know, I've said it before we started tape, and I think it's a great idea now. I think, you know, it's a fantastic job. But, you know, that was you know, I spoke against that rise. And then in the afternoon, and you know, we told the executive firmly that, come back in the afternoon, give us another, you know, we're in a negotiating position, come back and give us a chance to give you some money. We didn't want to skin the union, we know we got to pay. And, you know, you only get what you pay for. But, you know, they hadn't done anything for us that year. They, you know, the pay rise we got hadn't been really, I don't think, executed well. We accepted a fairly low offer, and, you know, then we were going to ancillary workers who were student nurses and asking them to pay an awful lot of money, and it didn't seem fair. So in the afternoon, I reversed my plan, because the offer was, you know, the asking then was a little bit lower, and it's something I felt my members could afford without, you know, me losing them all. And I spoke in favour of that, you know. So yes, we do. We do have our wins with the national executive, and they're not, I don't believe they're the final voice in the union. I believe they're very necessary, and I believe that they should make the intermediate policies. But I believe conference is the supreme council of this union.
That's the difference. Something like the RCN, where the conference is just an advisory body,
right,
isn't it?
Yeah. That's got to be wrong. You know, I mean, their conference should decide this week whether they're going to accept that money or not.
But they can't, of course.
But they can't, because they've got no power. But if this was our conference falling this week, I believe our conference would be really qualified to make that decision. Because I respect, you know, if you take our conference, it's a magic time, really. You know, you've got a very, very good cross-section of the people you represent in this union. In that conference hall, the conference hall reflects the amount of what your members are. You know, we got the guy sits in our region. He's a Tory. He belongs to the Tory trade unionists. If you ever heard of anything so stupid, but he's a very active man in this trade union. He's a branch secretary. He does a very good job. He's also the benevolent officer for our region. He does far more than most socialists do, you know. So, you know, you got him, and you got someone not so far right as him, and you got some people who are very far left, and Socialist Workers Party in there, some of the militant tendency in there, you know. And then you got people like me, you know, who just try to make sure that the union is on the right lines and doing the right thing to encourage a bigger membership. Because that's the only way we really live, is by our membership. You know, we take all the membership away. It doesn't matter what Albert says. No one's going to listen to him. It's only listening to him now because we're over 200,000 or 250,000 or 500, whatever it might be, you know. And I think that's important, that the conference is the magic body, and it is entitled to make decisions, and those decisions should be more binding on the union than they actually are.
Because they don't always implement.
No,
I mean, there was this thing. I mean, regardless of the issues, there was the national abortion.
That's right. Now, I believe that was handled completely wrong. I believe. Excuse me. I believe that, whether you believe in abortion on demand or not, or whether you believe in NAC, you know, National Abortion Campaign, whether you believe in their actual prospectus, for the use of a better word. I don't think that's important. I think what is important, that we should have been allowed, without all the folderols and all the red herrings being drawn across and everything else, I think that should have been whittled down to one composite resolution where it says, shall we or shall we not affiliate to the National Abortion Campaign? Never mind, you know, the ones shouldn't have been accepted where they said, we want to review last year's commitment, we want to do this, we want to do that. You see, there was one resolution that, having said one thing, said exactly the opposite, you know, and so it caused a lot of confusion. And I think at the end of the day, the NAC were as confused as we were, because I spoke to a couple of NAC blokes, and they just didn't know what had happened either, you know. And
because of the confusion, that's what led to the non-affiliation. Yeah. Yeah. But do you think conference is always quite aware of its power, or that power is a lot of the time lying dormant?
That's right. I think a lot of the power is lying dormant. And I think the General Secretary is in absolutely a wonderful position. Because a lot of people at that conference, and it's sad to say this, not a lot, I would think some, I think that's a better word, go there for the booze and the birds and the good time. And that's sad. That is very sad, because they come there at the union's expense. And I believe they have a right to do the job they're sent to do. Now, I enjoy my booze, no one more than me. But I never miss an opening time at that conference. And I'm there till the end every day, even on the Friday. Now, I believe that is the least you can do. But you see, then you've got people who have come there, and they sit there, and they sit there dutifully. But whatever the General Secretary says is right. And they don't listen to the argument. They listen to what the General Secretary says. Now, unfortunately, you know, Albert is not JC, or he's not the Pope, you know. And he is fallible. He's like me. He can make mistakes. And I think he made a mistake last year when he disbarred some of our members from coming in to listen to the debate on pay. And I think it was on pay where we had the big discussion over whether they would be allowed in. And the attitude was, oh, we'll get a lot of strangers getting in. Well, that couldn't have happened, because all you had to have was anyone who didn't actually have a visitor's ticket just sending in for the delegate or the branch secretary, and he could have come out and verified whether they were there or not, you know, whether they were bona fide stewards or members or whatever. I thought that was appalling. I thought it was also appalling that two of our members were manhandled by the police and thrown out of the foyer, and no one got upset about that.
I wasn't aware of that.
No, but I saw this, you know, and I tried to get to the rostrum, and I was told off, you know, and there was another silly pillock on the rostrum, and he wasn't making much parts of it. But I think we lost a lot of credibility as a trade union that day. Okay, so the position was reversed the next day when I was coming back at lunchtime, or just after the lunchtime, and I'd been held up. Someone had spoken to me on the road, and it was just a few minutes late, and we were coming back, and I see these crowd of lads shooting up the back steps, you know. And they were the guys I'd supported the day before, you know, and I'd said, these guys are bona fide members. And of course, I'm forgetting my ill health. I was off up the stairs after them, and when I seen them with the door open, I clocked one of them, you know. Not much of a pacifist, really, but they so incensed me, you know, that I said to them, look, you're trade unionists, you're not bloody burglars, you don't have to go in anywhere by the back door. I said, let's do it democratically. I said, you know, you've made a fool of me, and you've made burglars of your bloody selves. I said, what future's in that? We've lost democratically. Well, let's lose it, and, you know, let's do something else about it. But all the things I'd intended to do about that, I kind of went off doing, because know, you don't want to associate with someone who's smashing bloody windows and acting like a child because they don't get their own way. You know, I've lost my own way lots of times in the Labour Party and in conference where I particularly wanted a resolution to get through, you know. And you lose, and okay, that's what democracy is about. You're not going to win everything.
Yeah.
And they, I was a bit ashamed of them at the end of the day, you know, but maybe they'll grow into it.
Did you get involved in the Labour Party at the same time as you got involved in the union?
Oh, no, I was in the Labour Party long before.
Of course, you're in the army, yes. I forgot.
You mentioned in the army. I was in the Royal Marines.
Done it again. And, I mean, yeah, the question I was going to ask quickly... Going off on that boob, the branch started off amongst ambulance workers, but then spread elsewhere, did it?
Yeah, well,
how did that happen?
Yeah, well, we started off and out as ambulance, and then, as you say, and then what happened? There was a failing branch at King Edward's Hospital, which is Ealing, quite close to the ambulance station where I'm stationed, and. Pat McGinley asked me would I go down and give him a hand, the branch secretary down there, a hand with his books. Because he was in a terrible mess, he hadn't made any branch returns for a number of quarters. One other thing had gone wrong there anyway. The guy was a night telephonist, and I got there and he was a very old man who was also very sick. He had heart trouble and asthma. And when I walked in, he just said to me, oh, thank God, I explained who I was, you know, and he said, oh, thank God, he said, someone's going to take it over, and he just gave me the books, and that was it. And at that stage, I think there was about 27 members there, and I was quite happy with that. I knew nothing about nurses or ancillaries or, you know, other than just bumping into them in the normal course of my job. So I thought, no, I won't bother with it, I'll just leave it. And then I decided, well, I might as well build it up and see if I can get someone to take it over, you know. So at that stage, there was only the Royal College of Nursing there, and they were the only ones allowed to go in and speak to the School of Nursing. So I asked for permission to go in and speak to the new student, and it was refused. So I told him I felt that this was totally unjust, and he said, oh, well, we'll stop the college as well, if that's how you feel. So at least we stopped the college going in, you know, but they were no way were they about to let us go in. So what I'd done then, I used to make it my business to be in the hospital every Wednesday morning, because I knew that was the day the girls come down to get the new uniforms. They'd start on the Monday, you see, and they'd come down to be measured for the uniforms. And at 10 o'clock, they were turned loose to the canteen. So we used to hit them in the canteen, you know. And
eventually, metaphorically speaking.
That's right, yeah. And have a great big recruitment campaign. And we were getting every student that come in, because nobody else was bothering to approach them for about 2 or 3 weeks later, you know. And we were there. By then, they were cosy members. And they were some of our good members, you know. They were really good members. They were students. King Edward's was a very, very old-fashioned hospital, you know, and they didn't really believe that students had any say at all, you know. And they had this crazy rule that everyone had to be out of the nurses' home at 9:30 at night, and that, you know, they were, you could only get pregnant after 9:30. You couldn't have intercourse with a guy or anything like before 9:30. And that was the golden hour, you know. After that, everything suddenly sprang loose, nurses running around naked and raping men and God knows what else, you know. And we decided that this would be... A couple of the girls had complained, you know, that the guys had come down and they were kicked out at 9:30. They used to have to go around the pub. So we decided that we would break that rule, you know, and we took that aboard, and we eventually got the rule rescinded.
What, you did you break it as well, or?
Well, I didn't break it because I had no need to go there, being a married guy, you know, but I was one of the breakers because I was one of the people who got in the nurse's home at 9 o'clock and decided I wasn't going to move for anything, you know, and we forced this home warden into, you know, saying to me, you'll have to go. I said, why? You know, she said, well, it's not allowed. Men are not allowed. I said, well, why? And she didn't know why men weren't allowed. And she eventually, to cover her embarrassment, said she'd call the police. You know, I said, well, don't you think that'd be a bit silly? You know, you'd heap yourself in embarrassment and everything else, you know, I said, and bring the hospital into disrepute. I said, I'll go at 10:30. So we all sat round with her sitting at the end of the room, like, watching us, and that we didn't do anything wrong, you know. And we did, that was a broken. And then, of course, the district administrator and the district nursing officer were involved, and they wanted to know why, you know. And I said, well, you know, don't you trust your nurses? Seems I trust them more than you. Yeah, but we're parentis locum. I said, not anymore, you know. You know, that went out the door years ago. I said, these girls are looking after sick people. They're sometimes deciding between life to death, you know, whether they will make the cardiac arrest call or not. And I said, you're saying that they are not fit enough to be the masters of their own body or to tell a guy when to get lost. I said, I personally have got a lot more faith in them. And after a long, I think the meeting went on for about 3.5 hours, you know, they eventually reluctantly agreed to waiver the rule, but it would still be put in the prospectus. And it still is to this day, it's put in the prospectus, but nobody bothers to uphold it, you know. And it's not a bad thing that it's still in the prospectus when you look at it, you know. I was totally opposed to it at the beginning. But if a nurse is really, you know, causing hassle to her colleagues, and I'm not worried about it from the management's point of view, but if she's causing a lot of hassle, and we've had it, you know, where one nurse has been making life intolerable for 2 or 3 or 4 or even a whole floor of other nurses, you know, with her attitude, and people coming in at 3 and 4 in the morning singing and shouting. And at one stage you had a guy playing a guitar and, on the landing, you know. And so we invoked the rule against her, you know, and that frightened the life out of it, the fact that she was going to be thrown out. And maybe it's not a bad idea that the rule is still there, you know.
It's fallen into disuse.
That's right. And as long as everyone plays the game by it, you know.
Monday. So often happen in trade unionism, you don't worry so much about what the book says, but you...
That's right. The agreement you work to, you know, and as long as people are all prepared to keep the agreements, then there's no need to rub the fine print out. But, you know, I never forget, we had this, while we were in this negotiation, we had a very... very straight-laced lady who was sitting in on it, you know, and she was the divisional nursing officer. And she said, Mr. Dunn, she said, do you realise really what these girls could be up to, you know, with guys staying all night? I said, yeah, of course I realise, I'm a man of the world, you know, but I said, look, miss, I won't name her, I said, look, you know, I've always found that, you know, somebody who's loudly playing the radio is more disturbing than somebody who's quietly screwing. I said, because they don't seem to make a lot of noise, you know. I said, but if you've got somebody playing the radio loud, they're much more disturbing to the other people on the floor than the person who's screwing. Oh, Mr. Dunn. Oh, he said, we can't, you know, the administrator said, we can't accept this kind of language. He said, hey, this is what we're talking about, you know. To screw or not to screw, that is the question, you know. And we eventually, I think we embarrassed them into, you know, it was getting so embarrassing that they eventually backed off, you know, and allowed us to just carry on. And we'd done a few other things there, like good things, I thought, you know. One of the nurses was complaining to me one day about the state of a bed. It was like a ploughed field, and true enough, it was one of the old flock beds, you know. And I went up in the room and I had a look at this flock bed, and it was, you know, you wouldn't have slept on it anyway, you know. So it even made it worse. We found out that there was enough beds to put one in each room, and they were being stored in the nurses' recreation room. The nurses couldn't use the recreation room because the beds were stored in there, and they needed the beds, you know. Yeah. So that took us, silly enough, that took us 3 days to get those beds issued, you know. And then and the nurses then started to come. They realised that if they stuck together, you know, they could really do something, and they could make changes in the hospital.
But a lot of it was about things in the home, not so much on the wards.
That's right, because you know, there was no real need on the ward. The wards were, at that stage, very adequately manned, because we weren't suffering the cuts that we're suffering at the moment, you know. So the wards were adequately manned, and at that stage the nurses didn't think they had any chance of actually turning a nursing officer over or anything like that, you know. And that, I suppose that we sailed along like that for about a year, and we easy thing to say is we doubled the membership, you know.
What period was this then, roughly?
Oh, about 8 years ago, I suppose.
Yeah.
You know,
so early 70s.
That's right, yeah. And it was hard for a nurse then, you know. Things still hadn't come out of the closet, you know. Nurses lived a much more rigorous discipline than they do now. And
wasn't like angels, where they're all so nice to them.
No, nothing like that. They were under discipline, but that's what they expected, so they didn't see any big hassle in it, you know, they didn't see any wrong. So the other thing that we decided, we had to then make some inroads into the actual working of the hospital. And one of the things that always appalled me was the split shift system. I could never agree with that. So the branch meetings were quite well attended at that stage, you know, really well attended. And
like how many?
Well, we used to get about 2/3 of the membership there. Really? Well, the membership wasn't that big, you know, but I mean, I suppose we had about 100, 120, you know. Mm. So you'd get about 2/3 of that there, because we used to hold it in the nurses' recreation hall, and we used to supply coffee and biscuits, and then afterwards we'd put a record player on, and the ambulance men would have a bit of a disco going, and, you know, there was something to bring them there. And, you know, they all had something to tick about as well. And we decided that we'd beat the split shift system, and we'd done that. And we just recently got a new nursing, divisional nursing officer. And she wanted to change the hours anyway, which we thought were a good thing, or was a good thing. And we sold her this split shift system for the hours we wanted to work anyway. You know, the hours were more advantageous to us anyway, or to the nurses. And we beat the split shift system on that. And I think that's where we've done business, you know. We've tried to negotiate most of the things. And I think that sometimes that's what's lacking in the union and in all unions. You know, we too often go for the final alternative before we've taken all the options. We don't really take the bother of seeing if we can really negotiate a way around it, you know. The thing that springs easily to my mind, having said that, is we had a satellite station of Hanwell Ambulance Station, and it was called Brentford. And it was so bad and so old and dirty and pigeon droppings all over the place that we decided that it was a health hazard and we'd pull the guys out of there, you know. So we pull them out, and they all come to Hanwell Station. And obviously it got very overcrowded, and people were getting on each other's nerves, and fisticuffs almost coming about, you know. Well, as you know, fisticuffs is the final straw in any health service, and you could be sacked. So we decided we'd try and get some other accommodation for them, and the management were totally, couldn't care less, because they hoped we would get so browned off we'd go back into this Brentford. So the obvious thing, they said, no, there's nothing we can do for at least 5 months, you know, you've no chance. The obvious thing we should have done was struck. Mm. But you know, if you strike, all you really succeed in doing is taking money out of your members' pockets. And that's your job, is to put more money in, not take it out. Oh, that's as I see it. And we had a branch meeting, or a station meeting. And at that stage, everyone on the whole complex by now was in Cosy, some 100-odd members in the ambulance service. So we then worked out ways we could beat them without actually striking. And I made them a suggestion that if we put tents up on the lawn in front of the ambulance station and let the people of Ealing know that we had to put tents up to make room for us to live, you know, it might work. So everyone thought this was a fantastic idea. I said, okay, 4 or 5 of you go home, get your tents, bring them back, because a lot of ambulance men camp, you know. And away they went, you see, and I come in 8 o'clock the next morning, and they fell off me car. The whole lawn was full of tents. Everybody seemed to have tents, and everybody wanted to get in the act. Well, I was surprised, but you should have seen the officer. He near had a coronary, you know. And within an hour, the divisional nursing officer was down there. You can imagine, it's something like 30 or 40 tents parked on the lawn outside the ambulance station.
Is it near the hospital?
Right, it's right on the main road, right on the Boston Manor Road, which is the main one of the main roads of Hanwell. You know, the buses go past there and everyone was sitting on the buses chuckling away, you know. So the divisional officer come down very quickly and he said, right, get them down. Joke's over, get them down. I said, no way, they're staying, you know. So he said, well, he said, it's easy. He said, all I do is I have you all sent out on jobs and then we take them down. I said, okay, you do that. I said, but if you take them down, you know, we will then strike and we will let everyone know through the publicity, I said, that we were doing an industrial action that didn't hurt the patients at all and you forced us into taking the next step. And we'll name you, I said, because you're the guy who's going to cause the strike. If you can handle that, take them down. And he never did take them down, you know. And within 5 weeks, instead of 5 months, we had a new satellite station built.
It's a really nice story.
Yeah, and it works. And this is why I say, you know, what we try to do in our branch is try to take all the alternatives first, you know, not just to dive into strike action. I think that's too easy. And I think it's... Sometimes I think it's the resort of a weak...